Okay. Wow. So welcome everyone back to the podcast. And this episode is actually very curious because I'm speaking today with an incredible woman that I've just been chatting with for the last 20 minutes before we started. Her name's Caitlin Crossley. And the funny story here is that we just hired a cap desk, a guy called Kartik. And Kartik is actually also speaking with you guys, Caitlin over at Monolith. And sorry, we stole him away from you guys, but he was an amazing guy. So it was kind of funny how this came full circle. And Caitlin, it was super cool how you kind of reached out to me, and I've really fallen in love with your story. And I think on this episode, I think it will be so powerful of this chapter of the Unsung Hero to talk about your journey on how A, you got into Monolith. And for those of you listening, she just recently left Monolith, and she was the second employee, I think. So the first, pretty much the first proper hire. And that was almost 2.5-3 years ago.
Yeah.
For Monolith AI, which is this really cool company. So if you haven't heard of them, they're very advanced what they're doing. And I'm sure Caitlin can kind of give us a rundown. But we're going to speak a lot about Caitlin's journey. She's a mom, and what we just talked about was so powerful. And I think we'll jump around in different directions and how, you know, living through a pandemic and how she's been bold enough now to walk out on a high during a pandemic, and kind of what's going to happen next. But Caitlin, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast, and I'll probably hand it over to you to give a bit of an intro for the next few minutes on yourself. You know, who are you? You know, what is Monolith, and what was that all about? And, you know, a little bit more about your history. I think I'd love to kind of go deep on that to start.
Yeah, sure. Sounds good. And thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I'm very much looking forward to having an open, kind of honest conversation.
It's going to be hot. It's going to be good. I'm super pumped.
Thank you. So I'm Caitlin. I worked at Monolith for almost 3 years, and I was the first hire. So if you count the CEO, so it was the CEO and myself right at the beginning. And Monolith AI, the simplest way to explain it, and the way that kind of Richard, the CEO, has talked about it, is if you've seen the film Iron Man, and even if you haven't, the main character, whose name is escaping me at the moment, is incredibly smart engineer, and he's building the Iron Man suit, and he's building lots of other cool tech. And when he comes up to his computer, he says, "Jarvis, I need to build X," and his computer talks back at him. And so Richard had this kind of grand vision to build an AI assistant for engineers that build complex products. So the kind of aerospace, automotive engineers. So that's what Monolith is doing. So I joined them to...
And pause. How could you forget? The guy's name is Tony Stark. That was Tony Stark. No, that was amazing.
Well, you can see that I'm not into
engineering. You guys are doing the real world Tony Stark.
Yeah, so I joined Monolith after a kind of short phone call with Richard, where he said he needed a get shit done person. And those are the exact words he used. So I kind of came on board one day a week as a freelancer to get shit done. And after a few months, it kind of massively expanded from there to where I became kind of COO, Chief Operating Officer.
So that's kind of like on that point then, I mean, if we just jump into that one and kind of geek out here for a second. So that means, you know, you didn't really officially apply for the job, right? You just kind of, you knew Richard from connections previously. And then you just kind of started, you thought what they were doing was really interesting, and you kind of jumped in to help, and that kind of evolved. How did that process work?
Yeah, it was very fluid. It was very scrappy. So he had a whole bunch of things that he was trying to do. It was within the Founders Factory Accelerator program, and he was getting lots of help in lots of different areas. And kind of founders and first employees get lots of advice about how you should be doing X, right? And it's great to talk about that, but what you actually need is the energy and the people to actually deliver those things. So how we got started was just taking that list and all that great advice and great ideas and just trying some and seeing what stuck.
And wouldn't you agree, like, the most underrated thing that is missing, especially in those really early startups, is just people who can rawly execute. That strategy is great and strategy is important, but I would almost think, and even from our early days at Clio, remember when we were speaking, it was just about getting it done. Like, you know, you can strategize all you want, but if you have a great budget and a plan, if none of it's getting done fast enough, then you just, all that becomes redundant.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree. And that's kind of, I think, why I made an impact with Richard, is he was working with and being advised by people who were just putting the strategy there, and giving him a taste for what it looks like to do that actual implementation. Because nothing in my background shouts, I'm going to be a great COO of an engineering, data science, and software company. You know, I don't tick those boxes, but yeah, I could deliver and I could step into that role, which I think is something that I talk about because I think there's lots of other people out there who can also add value to companies that don't tick those boxes. Do you know what I mean? And much to credit to Richard's kind of openness of seeing in me that I had that and kind of pulling it out.
But it makes tons of sense. And I think the other thing there, which is also super important to highlight, is that you just said it, you do not have the typical background of a COO in that type of company, right? So if that was a job ad going up, you probably would never have applied to it, because like, I don't fit this mold. I have no idea what I would be doing in this company. And I think, and this is like on the previous episode with Sophie Teen, you know, we spoke about this concept where, you know, and this is not being sexist, I'll be really honest, but like women apparently, and this is a bit more generic, if you don't fit 80% of the job spec, typically you don't apply. And I think that is such an powerful thing to think about if anyone's listening. Like, if you see a company where you think you can add value, there's no job spec yet. And we were speaking about this just before, right? You know, find a smart way to reach out to the founders, especially for the early startups. Figure out, even though you don't fit the mold of a typical role for X, you know, if you think you can add value, which seems like that's exactly what you did.
Yeah.
That's how you get in. You don't need to go the traditional apply for a job, go through the interview process, X, Y, Z. And I don't know how many people are aware of that process.
No, totally. And I think there's also something to be said for, and this is where you kind of your audience and listeners to this have to be really clear on where their boundaries are, is coming in and being humble about it. So if I can just add some like meat to that statement, is I just left management consulting on, you know, X salary, and coming in and working with Richard, I said, this is my day rate. You know, you can have me for this much. And they couldn't do that at the time. So I said, and I believed so much in what he was doing and his energy that I said, okay, I can do it for X. And I came on a really low kind of day rate within kind of 2 to 3 months that had massively changed and shifted. And it kind of, my salary and package grew with the company. But so often, at least when I was still in Monolith, we'd get contacted by people pitching themselves, which was great, but kind of outpricing themselves. Now, I think that's kind of, it goes hand in hand, right? Because if you've got the expertise and you've got the context, charge what you're worth. But if you're looking for a foot in the door and to add value and to experiment, and you just, it's time, right? Like, I have a very low day rate for a month, 2 months, that's it. That might be helpful. That we haven't talked about that before, but that just came up as you were saying that for me.
I think there are so many young hustlers, I'll call them.
Yeah.
You know, they're ambitious. They want to go. They maybe have 2 or 3 years experience. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this is entitlement, but a lot of them are punching really above their weight, which is a great thing. You know, you want to go for the stars, whatever. But if you don't have the foundations, you've been through a few rodeos, you know how to handle certain situations. If you come into, especially a startup, and I think a lot of younger people think, coming to a startup, I can get a super cool senior role really quickly, right? I can climb the ranks. And yes, in one sense, but I think it's very dangerous to do it that way, where instead, go to a startup if you really want to learn a lot, because you're sacrificing those big salaries that you can get from a corporate. I mean, that's the fundamental thing. And, you know, now I work at CapDesk, right? So then you trade off for equity. And equity is a black box sometimes. And it needs to be communicated that, in theory, this is a gamble. This might be worth zero. So don't think about your salary negotiation on that becoming super valuable. That's the real truth. Like that's a bet. But I think that's where people, you know, I love that you mentioned just stay humble. Man, people are unhumble. There's a difference between being cocky and being humble, but like come in, add value. But what you haven't said, Caitlin, which I think is the most impressive piece of this, is that before you joined Monolith, you became a mother. Mm. How on earth do you go from being a mother with like a 1-year-old, jumping in as number 2 employee in a company and going through that growth journey? Tell me more about this, because I'm sure any potentially maybe even any other early mothers that are wanting to do the same thing, it's not a typical journey, right? It's quite a unique one.
Yeah, totally. So it obviously wasn't what I had planned. You know, as I said, I found out about, maybe I didn't say, I found out about Monolith like, through a friend of a friend and started freelance, started one day a week. And part of that was because she is, and she was and is the most important thing to me. And I wasn't prepared to kind of invest myself fully in anything, because I had to balance the kind of unpredictability of that. My husband has a big corporate job with the long corporate hours, and that just didn't kind of vibe with me. And so from the beginning with Richard, with Monolith, I was always talking about her. You know, it wasn't just about kind of necessarily leaving early or working flexible on certain days. It was just the fact that, you know, oh, I'm a bit tired today, because she was up kind of 7 times in the night. And being able to talk about it in a way that it was just kind of part of life. I wasn't you know, viewed differently. And I think as we grew, and I can talk more about that, but I think as we grew, I was really amazed to see how the way we built that kind of culture and the way of openly talking about things, people who didn't have kids also were openly talking about kind of their highs and lows and their human things. If that makes sense. I mean, there's, and I can dive into anything that I've said, but for me, it was the kind of hours that I put in a lot of hours, but I was there for the things that were important to me for my daughter, in terms of, you know, picking her up and putting her to bed and putting my phone aside and, you know, constantly signing off with, I'll be back in 2 hours, I'm doing bedtime. And then, you know, working later, you can only do a certain amount of that before you kind of, you know, burn out. But it was something that I set the rules and I set the parameters and worked accordingly.
Would you say though, that was also because you set those rules from the beginning? So, you know, you had your daughter, and, you know, from day one, when you walked in, you kind of set your terms, like this is the situation and this is what's going on. Okay. I wonder how it feels for, you know, potentially other women out there who maybe are recently or planning to, you know, get pregnant, right? That's a very scary thing. Mm-hmm. And I think I have 2 very strong female women in my life, my mother and my sister. And, you know, they brought me up thinking like, you know, you pave your own way. Mm-hmm. But there is this stigmatism where if you want to have a child, right, you have to kind of park your life for 1.5 years.
Yeah.
And your peers, they go beyond you, right? And that's so wrong for me. Like, can you not do both if you wanted to? Mm-hmm. But what do you think now then with the whole remote setup and with COVID? Do you think this is going to be almost like a blessing in disguise to enable more of this flexibility to kind of not have to do these massive 2-hour commutes if you might have to? And what do you think that's going to do? I'm actually a bit, I'd love to hear your opinion.
Massive blessing in disguise out of necessity, right? Kind of even I hope to see kind of a rebalance of parenting as well, as it's not just the moms who have the kids in the background, you know, after school, but it's also the dads. At least for us, that's how it's played out. Of during lockdown in the UK, one of us worked from 6 a.m. kind of till midday, and the other one worked until 10 p.m. And obviously that's not sustainable, but it exposed him to being more involved in the day to day. And he's, you know, he's cut his hours and he's gone down to 4 days a week. So he has an entire day with my daughter. So I hope it's not just a rebalancing for the moms, but also for the dads. I don't know if I've answered your question.
No, it's super on point, right? But I also think the other thing that this comes down to is execution again, right? So if you are really good at your job, you can dictate your hours because you know in X time you can get X done. I think for, and this is for people who are maybe more junior in their career, you know, they're mad hustling. They're just trying to figure things out, right? But I think when you get, and maybe your consulting background gave you a lot of frameworks and a lot of structure to execute on top of. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm sure that definitely helped. And then the chaos, how do you, but it's like, I think, and this is where I think employers need to just, you know, F off, just give me some space. Like, you can measure me on my performance. And I don't know, it's really, we just went remote first, right? So we've just, we're experimenting, right? And we've become way more productive than we ever were before. We're doing way better. And when you give that level of freedom, I think trust should always be given until it's broken, especially if you hire well. Because it just does something.
No, I totally agree. I heard you say that in another podcast episode. I totally agree. And I think we had at Monolith something called a core working hours, which was that between the hours of 10 and 4, you're expected to either be kind of online or in the office. But what that doesn't mean, what that means is, you know, if you need to leave at 4 for a dentist appointment or for whatever, you don't have to ask for permission. Because what at least I was finding is people who have worked at a few companies and then joined us were like, you know, I need to take an hour and a half lunch break today because of X. And I'm like, you don't need to ask. You don't need to tell us. You know, we're measuring on kind of value and output, not on kind of hours you're working. And I think for parents, that rings really true because you have time constraints that you haven't had before. And that, I mean, obviously you can draw those boundaries wherever you want. Like, I very much could have gotten a nanny that was with us 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. and not done any of that and not had those time pressures. And that could have been, that's a great choice to make. It wasn't the choices I made. So I think that something I wanted to say when you were talking about hustling and all these young people who are doing the hustling is, I think that's great. I think what's missing for the conversation for me is the power that we can choose to draw the boundaries any way we want. It don't have to be a parent. You don't have to, you know, for me, it was very much until I was a parent, I couldn't draw those boundaries because it was about me. Whereas now it was about her and I found that easier. But actually, I think that's, it's so important for so many things. One, you're not investing your time in one single place. Two, your mental health and energy. You have to, those kind of 90-hour weeks, it's impossible to sustain that. Yeah. In my opinion.
I'm super curious to see, you know, I wonder if there is definitely a correlation with, you know, really early parents who then jump into startups. They must be just mega productive because they have to be. Mm-hmm. And they just know how to prioritize their time. I mean, Martin, our CTO, our CIO, he also has kids, right? So he will occasionally be like, guys, I'm offline for 3 hours because something to do. I have to pick up the kids. But then, you know, he comes online again later and he gets his work done, right? And I think it's this understanding of that balance. And, you know, you prioritize what's really important to you in your life. But obviously your job is also part of that. But I love that. That's super interesting, Caitlin. Thank you so much for sharing that perspective. But let's jump into quickly, maybe towards the end of this, let's jump into the growth. Number two employee to leaving around when they were like 30 or so, right? What was that like? Tell me.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was scrappy. It was fun. And it was messy. And it taught me so much about experimenting, about just trying things, about seeing kind of where the opportunity is, even if you don't think that's where it is. And really how to build things from the ground up, but constantly changing them as you bring kind of new people on board. So for me, it was especially interesting because, which I think is kind of not normal in other kind of startups, is the hires we are making were kind of PhDs. They're experts in their field and they have highly technical knowledge, and their customers working with kind of the best engineers in the business. It creates this kind of energy, this kind of hot, kind of, what's the word?
Is it like hyper-intellectualness?
Hyper-intellectualness. Yeah, like hyper. I mean, I had someone come and visit me who works at a big accounting firm, one of my friends, and he kind of just stepped into the office and was like, you know, I didn't know places like this existed to work at. You know, you could get like Google and Facebook, those kinds of environments, fine. This was just slightly different. And And what I loved about those kind of early days is there were no egos in the room. We were all there to experiment and drive the business forward, but we also recognized that we also had kind of lives outside of work, which I know is different from the traditional startup vibe of like, you want to eat and, you know, eat, drink and breathe the startup. We kind of always had that balance from the beginning. So
yeah.
And sorry, did you want to say something?
No, I'm agreeing with you.
Mm. And one thing I like to talk about is because that you talk about with Unsung Heroes, how all the information out there is about founders and entrepreneurs. And now you're focusing on the kind of employees, and you talk a lot about the scaling journey from kind of 20 to 100 or 200. And for me, that kind of the beginning part of a startup journey is also super important and also has its own kind of challenges. And so for me, kind of leaving Monolith before it scaled, I struggled with that decision. You know, don't I want to have that success story? But actually, there was lots of success along the way, and lots of value and lots of lessons. And so for me, talking about those beginning stages, I think is something we could do more of as well. So I've kind of covered lots of different topics in there.
No, but I love it.
I've got a lot to say, if you couldn't tell.
Yeah, but this is where we can geek out massively, right? Because I think I'm such a big believer now in that these different startups have different evolutions.
Yeah.
And you need to be so goddamn self-aware as an employee of where do you fit in the ecosystem. It's like, hey, am I a super early employee? I like being, you know, pre-number 10 because it is complete chaos. It is like scrappy. It is survival mode. It is hopefully being surrounded by people who are just really good at what they do. And there's just this super good connection between us because literally we're sitting in a room where we can just talk to each other. And that level of raw execution, it works for that company at that size. But that doesn't work when you go to like 25 to 50, because then you lose those closer bonds, and it becomes a little bit more about processes. You need to have like not necessarily a chain of command, but a way of getting shit done quicker, because that's where when you've hopefully raised a seed round, you need to start proving results, and it becomes maybe less so about just raw survival, but it's survival and showing results.
Yeah.
And making that public, right? And then the next stage, Series A, Series B, when you go to 150 people, the company evolves completely. And I think it's super healthy for people to leave if you don't feel like you fit into this ecosystem anymore. But then the whole way that equity is structured, like, you know, you have a 4-year vesting period, people probably feel obliged to stay because they want to get their package before they jump out. And this is what I think needs to change. I think these things need to be much more negotiable. They need to be on different terms. But like when you came into Monolith, I've got a daughter. This is my life situation. I can give you this. You've seen by me working freelance for you that I can deliver X. Yeah. I can probably deliver that for the next 2-3 years. And then I'm going to hit a point where I probably cannot go more. Yeah. But that's an honest conversation. It's like, cool. You know, if we get to that point and I can deliver more, then I stay if I want to stay. But then what we need to do is have a plan of attack. So up until that point, maybe 6 months before my end of my 3 years, I would then perhaps engage in finding my replacement, someone who's going to come in, who's going to make, you know, I love people who think about their journey in a company as making themselves redundant.
Yeah.
That is a beautiful mindset, and not being afraid, because if you don't have that mindset, you hire shitty people because you don't want someone to compete with you.
Agreed.
But you should be like, God, I want to bring in someone who's going to make me level up, make me feel the stupidest in the room, because that's how I get smarter. That's how I learn my new skill sets for the next jump. That's the mindset that I think is powerful, but it's not for everyone.
No, totally. And it's a choice to have that mindset, right? Because you might have unconsciously have the other mindset, because that's just kind of what's standard.
And I think it's job security as well, right? It's like, you know, I get it. And, you know, if you have a family, if you have kids to feed, if you have a mortgage to pay, I'm speaking, and we spoke about this before, right? I'm a white male of privilege. I'm not going to even run away from that fact. I am. I have no kids. I have no debt. I have nothing. I can take risk. Yeah. But with that privilege, I am taking the risks, because if you have it, I think you should sort of take it. Mm. But don't complain about it. So I don't know. It's all about perspective. But I think the other thing that I wanted to say, and I'm kind of hijacking the podcast from you, God, I got to get better at this. I want to share something that I've learned to geek out with you, maybe on your next journey if you're going to do something cool again. The most powerful, and I'm going to write a blog post on this coming out at the end of the month. The most powerful thing that I've learned now as a CCO is that hiring in a very strong management team that is just no bullshit. Like, you know, we spoke about Kartik, you know, getting Kartik in to head up our growth. He's done 3 or 4 rodeos. He's seen the growth. He's seen the F-ups. He's seen the success. He has a real good, is plethora the right word? But he has good perspective on different size companies, different stages. Then we've got in Nikki, who's now head of CS or CS director. She's done it with Tripti. She's done it with, you know, Blow. She's done it with all these amazing companies. And then now we've hired Guillaume, who's going to lead out our tech team from Plio, who I worked with before. And then, you know, we're establishing this layer where they can reverse coach because they have hit a point in their career where they're executors. They know they have the foundations to build on, right? Mm-hmm. And that becomes an amazingly powerful tool in recruitment because then people want to work with these people to be coached and mentored by them. Mm-hmm. The other thing happens, which is a problem in other startups, they hire these young, ambitious people and they're great, but they're all reaching without direction, without focus, without like structure. Mm-hmm. And then no offense to founders, but founders are too busy fundraising, too busy doing X, Y, Z. So there's this massive, you know, knowledge debt, which is damaging. I think me and Christian were joking around about this, saying we should write an article. I think it was called like, you know, management debt. There's this massive management debt which is lacking, and that will bite you later. But it costs way more to hire strong people early. But if you have the funds to do it, pay that extra money, recruit really well, and it really pays off. And I'm so amazed by what's happening here right now at CapDesk. And it's blowing my mind because I'm not just hiring people that are great. I'm excited to learn from them. Like, I'm learning so much from them. And I think that is an amazing feeling when you can harvest that environment and that culture. But we'll see how scalable it is, right? But it's working at the moment. But that was my biggest learning in this kind of now 20 to 40 growth stage. Yeah. That's when you want to find those key hires that are going to take you to like 150.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, we definitely learned that at Monolith and at the beginning of the year made 2 kind of big hires, data science and product area, to be that layer in between and massively, you know, even within, they talk about the first 90 days being important, even the first 30 days, we saw that difference.
You can feel it, right? When you hire someone that is incredible, it's like, wow, you don't need any direction. You are jumping straight in. You know exactly where to press. You know exactly what to execute on in the priority. And it's just immensely valuable. And I think we've been super lucky with COVID, actually, because these people have become available, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, but that's what else was part of it. Just maybe to finish off, I think we're running out of time, actually, just to finish off the podcast, because this has been awesome. And I love your story, Caitlin. I think it is, I hope people listening, whether you're also maybe a mother or whatever, but like, what a story. I think it's, I did, you know, we've been connected since my Plio days, right? But, you know, I did remember watching Monolith. So like, I think you guys did so amazing and they're doing really well, but I just love these stories. I think it's so awesome to get perspective and for people to hear that because I didn't know you had a daughter. You know, I've always like, who's this woman that keeps hustling and she's doing, but you know, there's a story behind the story, right?
Yeah, totally. No, and that's why I love that you've done this podcast, because it takes time to bring out stories, right? And it takes finding the right medium. Sometimes it's not always a post on LinkedIn. Sometimes it is actually taking the time to be face to face and see where the conversation leads. Do you know what I mean?
So here's a left field question for you, because this one's, I'm recording a new episode, it's coming up soon, but it's kind of a topic area. How do you leave and exit a company well?
So at Monolith, we had a 3-month notice period.
Wow.
So we have had an array of kind of ways people have exited the company, from taking that as gardening leave to kind of working the whole period. For me, I only felt right working that whole time to hire my replacement, to kind of finish up the bits that I've been working on, and leave the company on solid footing. So sorry, was your question, how do you know when to leave a company or how to exit?
How do you exit a company? Well, because, you know, you have these horror stories of people resigning and burning bridges, you know. If you have this agenda, like maybe like we talked about earlier, you know, like I know my value is for X amount of time, but yeah, you know that in the back of your head, right? But how do you go about planning your exit in a gracious way, which doesn't leave your company you're leaving in a rubbish position?
Yeah. So going back to the basics, it's a conversation. Starting it as a conversation. People aren't blindsided by it. It's not a kind of aggressive email that you're sending out and kind of pulling the rug out from people. A conversation, because everyone is human, right? If you've chosen to leave, either you're not wanting to either do that anymore, or perhaps something's happened and there's like a bit of beginning to be bad blood, to use that word. And just remember having that perspective that we are all just humans and we just need to have that conversation. And kind of be okay with it. And it's something that I've always remembered from when I was a young kid and I saw my dad working really, really hard. And then there was this big kind of dinner to thank everyone that was involved in this particular project. And he wasn't thanked and he wasn't done at all. And he was the one kind of managing it and not directing it, but managing it. And I remember, and he kind of put his heart and soul into that. And so I remember feeling for him because that upset him. And so for me, I've always reminded our employees, and I had to remind myself, even though at moments I lost it, of like, I am an employee and this is a contractual relationship. As much as I'm emotionally invested in it, it's okay to have a conversation and change your mind and decide to leave. And it's okay to just remember that we're humans. And yes, it can be an emotional thing. Emotions aren't bad or good. They're just emotions. But there's a way to kind of keep those kind of relationships and bridges. And, you know, I am actually proud of how I exited Monolith, because it wasn't easy. It's not easy to walk away from something you built. It's not easy to, you know, leave the people that you love and enjoy spending time with. But ultimately you have to do what's right for you. And so having, you know, I still almost every other day or every week at least messaging kind of Richard and the CTO, Sarah, and we're still friends. And I value that relationship because we're humans and I had those conversations, you know, so that's at least that's how I view it.
It's gold. I mean, kind of everyone listening at those last 3 minutes, go back and listen like 5 times. I think, and that's such, you know, that taps into everything that I believe on. You know, I'm an employee advocate, but like, people, if you're an employee, don't forget that you're an employee. It's okay to be emotional, but don't get lost in being like, this company is my life, because this is what happens, right? You can get fired and that's okay. And you should be always ready for that. Or you can be like, you know what? I just don't want to work here anymore. Mm-hmm. And I want to take my talents in a different direction. It's like NBA, right? You know, these guys swap teams all the time and it's personal, but it's also, they're looking for what's the best fit for them. And, you know, you always want to be, I am a big believer in win-win scenarios. Okay. How do you win and how does the company win? So if you want to leave, great. That's a win for you because you've realized you're ready to leave. But then, you know, if you are leaving and you want to leave in 6 months because you're thinking about that, how do you then maybe organically bring that conversation up, find your replacement, and kind of do it in a great way? But I think employees are afraid of bringing it up and then getting fired.
Yeah.
Because, oh, you're betraying us. And that's where I would call out employers, you know, wake up, you know, your employees, and we talked about this, right? I love calling out the BS from founders. Our employees are our most valuable asset. That is not the right way to phrase it. I really believe our employees are our most valuable disposable asset. And that's true. It's why we have a contract in place. And that's okay.
Yeah.
But you just need to be aware of it. And you can always be passionate about where you work, but just find the balance.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And I think it's something that not only startups, but businesses kind of leverage and can get wrong, is making the business feel like home, or making it feel like a more familiar, family kind of environment.
It's a retention
tool. And actually, that's just, say again.
It's a retention tool.
Retention tool. Yeah. I had a conversation with an employee at Monolith and he was quite rightly asking for a pay rise. He's like, oh, you know, I'm sorry. I know we're, and he was apologizing. He was like, I'm sorry. I know we're friends and I know this is not like the way. And I was like, no, no, you are an employee. You have a right to ask for whatever you want. Like, just because we're friends, just because we're informal, just because we kind of value you, you still can ask for what you want. And I think I've been in environments in other companies where that's shunned upon. Oh my gosh, I can't believe he asked for a pay rise. You know, doesn't he see, do you know what I mean? I know you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. Like, but like, it's frustrating, right? Because those lines are so blurred.
I know, I know.
And companies like when they're blurred because it makes...
That's my point, is they are blurred, but I think it rests with leaders to draw those boundaries and keep pointing back to them. And that's what I tried to do in that in those conversations with him and other employees, is to make those lines unblurred. I know, and I think the reason why I give that example is it's not a principle, it's not a value. Our employees are the most valuable asset. It's something that you see in practice and have to deliver in practice, and it's in those conversations.
Yeah. And I think, again, for everyone listening, it's perspective, right? Because you and I were employees, we're not founders. Yeah. Yeah. I reckon founders have a different view on this because they're the founders.
Okay. Yeah.
Fair. And that's powerful to think about, right? Because they own the company in theory. But, you know, if you're an early stage employee, you probably have, you know, vested equity. You have also a position, but you will never be as close as owners and the founders. And I think that also leverages them to think like, how can I get the best deal for me? And it's such a tug of war. But that's where I really respect when the leadership team is so transparent on their modus operandi, how they operate, right? Like, this is how we go. Yeah. And we're doing some stuff right now internally at CapDesk, which I'm very proud of, because we are preaching transparency far beyond what I've ever seen before, even in the likes of Pleo. And I really respect that because it just puts everything on the plate. You know, you can choose to be part of this or you can choose not to be, but this is the way that it's going to be. Yeah. And there's no BS in between the lines.
Yeah, love that.
On that note, mic drop, boom. Caitlin, it's been such a pleasure. I love that we were able to finally connect after all these years of also being connected on LinkedIn, and love that you're a fan of the podcast. And I hope that we can meet in person for like a post-COVID drink or something like that. But loved your story. I hope everyone listening really found it valuable. I think go back and listen to it again. And connect with Caitlin, send her some love, send her some thoughts. You know, this is not a dictatorship. This is about getting people's opinions on different and difficult topics. So awesome stuff.
Okay. Thank you for having me. And thank you for the last hour. It's been a great conversation. And yeah, if anyone's listening, if you want to talk about anything, if you have any questions, as you said, disagreements about anything you've said, I genuinely would love to hear from you. Because I really believe in the kind of the message and the kind of energy you're trying to build around these kinds of conversations. So
awesome. Thank you. And now Caitlin knows my secret around what I'm building this for. So that will come in handy later. Yeah. Thanks, Caitlin.
Thank you.